is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
It's Thursday, September 5th, 2019, and this is the Baseball Tonight podcast. I'm Buster Olney, and producing the show back in Bristol, Troy Farkas. Well, on Tuesday, the Mets suffered that terrible loss against the Washington Nationals, blowing a six-run lead in the bottom of the ninth inning. Just 14 hours later, they faced the Nationals again, and you know what? They bounced back.
Here's Alonso, and he launches one. Deep to left. If it's fair, it's gone, and it is a long home run for Pete Alonso down the left field line, but way towards the back of those lower left field stands. Alonso has just hit his 45th home run of the year.
Howie Rose, WCBS, the Mets would win 8-4. Troy, I give him a little golf clap. Nice shot by the Mets bouncing back, because that was a rough one the night before. Are you with me, or are you like, whatever?
No, totally cool. And Buster, I think that's the first positive thing you've said about the Mets. Congrats to you. Golf clap for
you. Wow. Well, come on. That's a stereotype that I'm not very fond of. Reds played the Phillies. Phillies, of course, trying to make a wild card spot. And Michael Lorenzen had quite a night. He pitched in the seventh inning, two innings at all, and this is what he did in the eighth inning.
And he hits a high, deep drive into left center field. Did he get it all? You bet he did. How about that?
Pretty good call there, my friend.
He was due, and due he did.
Marty Brenneman, 700 WLW. Lorenzen finished the game, a Reds win 8-5, playing center field. The last player to get a victory, hit a home run, and play the outfield in the same game was Babe Ruth for the Yankees, June 13th, 1921, according to Stats, Inc. The race for the number one seed in baseball involves three teams, the Yankees, Dodgers, and Astros, and the Yankees played the Rangers in the final game of their series. Aaron Judge did some damage.
That one's drilled out to right field. There it goes! See ya! He finally got him. Timing it, and he puts it in the seats for his 20th home run, 2-0 Yanks.
Michael Kay on the YES Network describing how the Yankees got back at the former teammate Lance Lynn, New York, winning 4-1. The Dodgers played the Rockies. Jock Peterson has been red hot, and that continued on Wednesday.
Second throw.
Peterson crushes a liner. Deep right field and gone. Scalding hot, Jock Peterson. Well, apparently crashing into the wall the other day didn't do any damage to him. Peterson now 5 for his last 5 with 4 home runs. Sends another one. Right center field. Out of the park and out of his mind.
Joe Davis and Oral Hershiser, Spectrum Sportsnet LA. With that fourth inning home run, the Dodgers broke the National League record, hitting their 250th home run of the season. Of course, we have 3.5 weeks to go. Just another home run number going down. Houston was off on Wednesday. So at the end of the day, the Yankees with the best record in baseball, 92-49. The Dodgers, 92-50, a half game behind, and a game and a half behind Houston at 90-50. The Diamondbacks facing the Padres, and Zach Gallen was outstanding in this game. A no-hitter through 6 innings, and this is what happened in the seventh.
Amani at third, the pinch runner, Lamb at second, Dyson at first. There's a drive to right, grand slam Marte, 4-0 Diamondbacks, number 30. Listen to this crowd.
My goodness, that ball got out of here quickly.
Greg Schulte, Arizona Sports, 98.7 FM. Arizona hanging in the wild card race in the National League, wins 4-1 over San Diego. The Giants facing the Cardinals, and in the bottom of the sixth inning, the Cardinals took the lead.
And the Submariner fires, and a line drive in the right center is going to get down and drive home two. Goldsmith comes through with a double, and the Cardinals lead 8-7. He made that look easy, didn't he?
Mike Shannon on the Cardinals radio network. But in the top of the eighth inning, the Giants would rip out the Cardinals' guts with this hit.
Now the pitch. Fastball. There's a high drive into deep left center field. You can forget about this one. It is gone way back over the Giants' bullpen and high up into the bleachers. A spectacular two-run homer for Pilar, and the Giants are back ahead, 9-8.
The legendary John Miller, KNBR, and the Giants beat the Cardinals 9-8. At the end of the day, the Cardinals 2.5 games ahead of the Cubs in the Central, 2 in the loss column. The Red Sox at Fenway Park, the second game of their series. Eduardo Rodriguez is on the mound. He was really good. Mookie Betts was excellent at the plate.
Here's the pitch. And Betts swinging away, blast one. No doubt about this one to left center field. Look out, Lansdowne. To the back of the monster and over it, a three-run blast. Mookie Betts has seen two pitches tonight and served both over the Green Monster for home runs. He's driven in all four of the Red Sox runs. It is 4-0 Boston in the second.
Kevin Brown on ESPN Radio, and the final score would be 6-2. Eduardo Rodriguez, his 17th victory in this game. Oakland facing the Angels. Marcus Semien continues to have an excellent year.
And now the pitch to Marcus, and that swing on a high fly ball to left, way back, up and at the track. He'll turn and watch it fly. Two-run shot by Semien. His 26th home run. 4-0 A's in the fifth.
Ken Korak, 860 AM, the answer, and Oakland wins 4-0.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
The game of the day in Cleveland. The Indians trying to hang in there in the wild card race in the American League. They face the White Sox, and early on, it looked like they took control.
The pitch to Reyes, and he drives one high and deep to right center. Home run, Reyes! 6-2 Tribe as Reyes goes the other way again with power, and his big year continues.
That from WTAM 1100. And so the Indians had a big lead, but you know what? The White Sox would come back. They would pull to within two runs, and they loaded the bases in the ninth inning. There was one out, and this happened.
And the bases are loaded. Spanked to center. Racing back. Oh, my goodness, what a catch! Oscar Mercado, like Superman, nobody scores on the play. The bases are still loaded, and there are two down after an incredible leaping catch by Oscar Mercado in center field. It so stunned the White Sox base runners that they got caught watching.
What a catch by Mercado to snag it down. I thought that ball was over his head. My goodness, what a play.
Now the payoff pitch. Swung and drilled to deep center. Back goes Mercado. Leaping, diving grab. He made it. Everybody scrambles back. Nobody's able to tag or score. An incredible play by Oscar Mercado. How does he do it? Leaping and racing back at the same time to make the catch and falling to the turf.
3-2 for Eloy Jimenez. Bases loaded. Jimenez cracks it to center field. Mercado gets there. Oh, my goodness, what a play. Mercado saves the life of the Indians tonight with a brilliant gymnastic effort.
Now, keep it going. You got to keep it going, Troy. And I'll tell you, keep that going.
Give him the gold glove on that. Oh, my. What a play.
You have got to be joking. That is as great a catch as he'll ever make in his career. Here we are.
Yep, a lot of great catches. A lot of great catches. That's it, Troy. A lot of the announcers on all the various teams, for both teams, and the radio broadcast, the television broadcast, you heard like Superman, Eloy Jimenez, the White Sox who hit the ball, tip of the cap to Mercado making that catch. Jose Abreu was shaking his head. You heard Tom Hamilton talking about an incredible play. Jason Benetti saying, oh my goodness. Amazing catch, Troy. What do you think of the play?
I think the calls were a lot better than the catch itself.
Come on! Yeah, come on!
I've seen so many more impressive things than that this year. I mean, Aaron Hicks' game-saving catch earlier in the season. Delino DeShields robbed a home run last week. We're going to see much better catches on Sunday, week one of the NFL season, than we'll see from that. The guy, there was nothing.
Wow, that was a game-saving catch. Cleveland wins 8-6. At the end of the day in the American League wildcard race, the Rays a half game ahead in the race for the number one wildcard spot. Oakland, the Indians in a virtual tie. For the second spot, the Red Sox 5.5 games behind.
Keith Law is up next, but before we get to that, you've heard me talk about ButcherBox for months, and if you haven't taken advantage of their amazing offers, it's time to listen up. Every month, ButcherBox delivers humanely raised 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage breed pork, and wild-caught Alaskan salmon directly to your door. You can choose from four curated boxes or customize your own box with all of your favorite cuts. And with free shipping, ButcherBox makes it easier than ever to get high-quality meat with no added hormones or antibiotics. The last box I got came with chicken. It came with bacon. It came with hamburger. It came with steak. And for me, my favorite was the steak. My 15-year-old is a very picky eater, and he absolutely loved the steak. He's asked for it, so we've ordered more from ButcherBox. ButcherBox has a ton of awesome recipes and resources on their website that'll help you bring out the flavor of each cut of meat you get from ButcherBox. And this month, ButcherBox is offering new members $20 off your first box, plus free ground beef for the life of your subscription when you sign up at butcherbox.com/BBTN. That's right. In addition to all the great meat you get, ButcherBox is knocking $20 off your first box and throwing in 2 pounds of free ground beef in every box for the life of your subscription when you sign up at butcherbox.com/BBTN. butcherbox.com/BBTN.
It's more than just a conversation. It's the Weekly Dish with Keith Law and Bias Cat on Baseball Tonight.
Yeah, and Keith Law and Bias Cat, Scat for ESPN. They write for ESPN. They're on television for ESPN. And Keith, today I need you and Bias to be tiebreakers on the show, okay?
Okay.
we just had the game of the day, and we heard all of the amazed calls of Oscar Mercado's game-saving catch for the Indians. And Troy Farkas had a different view of that play. Troy, you can chime in here, defend yourself.
What?
Yes. Yeah, he didn't. He. There you go. That's what his perspective was, that he didn't think it was a very good catch.
I've seen so much better. I've seen so many more impressive things in my baseball fandom life. Yes, it was an amazing play given the situation, but for the actual catch itself, like he was going back. That was a routine play in the outfield. Every player should be able to do that. I'm not impressed.
Keith?
Oh, no. No. I can't even. Every player should be able to do it. So every defender in center is a 70 defender. That's not how it works.
That play was not impressive.
Oh my God.
Yes. Yeah. And here's the thing. Two of the calls that we heard, just coincidentally, were two former center fielders, Rick Manning and Darren Jackson. They're going, oh my God, what a play. You have Eloy Jimenez tipping his cap.
All the athletes are different nowadays. Every athlete can make that catch.
From where he started on that play? Yeah, I don't. I like Mercado. I'm a Mercado, absolutely a Mercado guy. Have been since the Cardinals converted him to center field about 3 years ago. I'm still impressed. Even I would have guessed from where he started on that play and how hard that ball appeared to be hit. I didn't think he was getting to that.
Right. Exactly. Troy, you're wrong again.
I'm shutting Keith's mic off.
No, please keep it open because I got to ask him about his article that's on ESPN.com today about September call-ups to watch. Keith, give us a couple names that really intrigue you for this month.
Yeah, I actually thought it was, and tell me if you disagree, but I feel like this is a better September call-up group than we've had in a couple of years. And part of that is just, some teams just call up guys when they're ready, right? We've seen like Bo Bichette, Will Smith, they were both called up in July. Teams don't necessarily wait till September. But in recent years also, a lot of teams have said, well, we're not going to call guys up just for that September look because we don't want to put them on the 40-man. We don't want to start their service time. This year, we get three guys off of my midseason top 50 just got called up in the last week or so, which I think is pretty good compared to recent years. Yeah. Gavin Lux, I think, is the most interesting of all because the Dodgers are clearly going to the playoffs. He's really good. He has gotten better each of the last two seasons, even as he's moved up the ladder. And because they have the opening for him at second base and they have the actual need for him in the everyday lineup. And it looks like they're going to give him the opportunity to play regularly. And even if that doesn't translate to a regular role in October, I think it does so much for them, gives them another option off the bench in October. It sets them up maybe for him to be the everyday second baseman next year. He's a natural shortstop. so they have more flexibility there if they need to move any other players around. It's just he was my number five prospect at midseason because he does so many things well. And his presence, I think, makes the Dodgers better in October and also allows them at the same time to think going forward about next year. And the one other guy I'll highlight too, AJ Puck. I mean, the A's are quietly still very much in the playoff race, and Puck is only, is it even 18 months off Tommy John surgery? 17 months, I think. Came back as and was working essentially as a reliever on a schedule in the minors as they worked him back, and looks like he'll continue to pitch as a reliever now with the potential to make a real impact for the A's out of their bullpen. But same as I was just saying for the Dodgers, this is also at the same time an audition for next year where I would imagine they'd like to see Puck make at least a bunch of starts in the big leagues for them next year. Cause he, right before he blew out, I don't know if you remember in spring training of 2018, people were saying this guy's ready to be a major league starter immediately. And then he got hurt almost immediately afterwards. And I wonder if they're going to look at him now and say, well, is the stuff all the way back? And mechanically, do we feel like he's all the way back that he could be a part of our rotation in 2020?
Yeah, definitely a guy, and I'm really curious about what they do with him as we go down the stretch here, because it looks like Oakland's got a real shot to make the playoffs, and he'd be an intriguing guy. We always see these pitchers emerge in September and into October and become factors in the playoffs. Just doubling back on Lux, he's such a fascinating player to me, not only because of what you hear about, you know, him as a hitter, but also with his presence. You hear so much about that, that he's someone who has tremendous makeup and someone who is going to be a part of what the central part of what they're going to be doing for years to come. What did you see in him when you watched him in person?
Yeah, I saw him in high school. I remember flying from, it was a weird trip, but I went to see Riley Pint and Joey Wentz, who was just traded from Atlanta to Detroit at the end of July. They were both pitching on the same day in Kansas City, from Kansas City to Chicago. So in Chicago, drove up to Wisconsin to go see Lux play. And I knew he was going in the first round. It's not like I had much evaluating to do. This was just good to go see him in person another time. But the area scouts up there in the upper Midwest, they all loved Lux, even though he was clearly a bit behind because, one, just because he was playing high school baseball in Wisconsin, so it's a short schedule. It's not, you know, the caliber of California baseball. And he needs to get stronger. That was the other thing that was very clear. But I thought the swing was good, looked like he had a pretty good approach. He really had good instincts in the field. He had good hands. He moved well. He was a plus runner. He just seemed to have – it's such a nebulous thing to describe. He really seemed to have good feel across the board, just an advanced understanding of the game, especially for a kid coming out of that cold weather environment where he hasn't played baseball at the same level of competition. And he had an okay first year in the minors, and it was last year that he really – took a huge step forward. He did get stronger. The Dodgers have done some excellent work with a lot of their hitting prospects the last few years, like Will Smith, who I mentioned in the article I mentioned earlier, somebody who another top prospect who came up earlier this summer. And I managed to unlock a little more power in Lux too. I did not think Lux would have quite so much power. I know some of it this year is the AAA ball, but he hit for power in AA. And I think that this is going to continue where he'll have above average power for a middle infielder, whether he plays short or second. I think he's going to be an impact bat for the position and could potentially – they probably won't do it now just because of the spot in the season, but he might be a pretty good leadoff option for them going forward because he's got such a good approach. He does have speed, which a lot of managers want at the top of the lineup. He's going to get on base at a good clip. But with the above-average power, maybe they could try him in some other spots in the lineup. And again, I think he'll provide good quality defense, whether he's at second, where he'll probably be plus – or it's short where he'll probably be average to above average, but absolutely good enough to play either spot.
Yeah, and as you project the Dodgers moving forward, if you were sitting in Andrew Friedman's shoes, where would you have him based on what you have?
It's the based on what you have, right? That's the entire – because in the abstract, right, if they had nobody else, he's a shortstop. He's absolutely a shortstop. And then the question becomes, okay, well, obviously you've got Corey Seager at shortstop, and Corey Seager, especially a fully healthy Corey Seager, is an MVP caliber player. You know, Seager hasn't been 100% back yet, but it's also his first year back from the surgery. And I wonder if there's maybe shaking off a little bit of rust here. But I would also ask the question too. He's exceptionally big for a shortstop anyway. Are we better off maybe moving Seager to a slightly easier position maybe so that he's focusing a little bit more on his bat and less physically taxed in the field. You can do that. I don't, you know, I'm not in the clubhouse. I don't know what, where Seager is kind of mentally or really physically at this point. But at least Lux gives you the flexibility to consider that, because Lux could be the everyday shortstop. He could also be a part-time shortstop. You could say, all right, we're going to have Seager play 80 games at short next year and maybe move him around a little bit. You know, kind of the way the Cubs have always done with Chris Bryant, third base. And then suddenly it was, you know what, maybe we'll put him in left field some more because we have that flexibility. It lets us get different players in the lineup. Maybe you do that with Seager so that he's not always playing the most defensively taxing position in the infield. And Lux just lets you be a little more creative. Very few teams have that flexibility of two guys who can play major league shortstop and help you offensively. And that's the Dodgers are very much in that situation.
And what we don't know about the Dodgers moving forward is who else they might target. For example, I feel like that they might be sleepers in mm-hmm. the possible pursuit of Anthony Rendon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, first off, it's not a typical Andrew Friedman type of move, but he is a classic Andrew Friedman type of player, the type of guy that Andrew likes. You know, the guy who doesn't strike out very much. He's got 75 strikeouts and 74 extra base hits this year. He's 29 years old, but I think if you're sitting in Andrew's shoes and the shoes of a lot of other executives, you can project probably with some level of confidence that within 2 or 3 years, there's going to be a DH in baseball. So you can invest in a player like Rendon at age 29 or 30 or 31 and say, okay, he's going to be a third baseman for the next few years, and then maybe he's move forward, maybe he's at first, maybe he's a DH in the last 3 years of the deal. And I'm really curious to see if the Dodgers jump in on that. And maybe, you know, the fact that they have Seager and Lux gives them the flexibility to bypass that deal. But I'd say watch Rendon and the Dodgers. What do you think?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially with Turner. I think Turner has one more year left on his deal.
Yep.
You could always move Turner to first base for next
yep.
year. Turner's still very productive, but he's going to be 35 next year. And at that point, it's fair to expect some offensive and defensive regression. So maybe, obviously, Turner can play multiple positions. Maybe he's somebody you move around since it is the last year of the deal. You don't want to pass on the opportunity to get a – Rendon doesn't get a lot of MVP support, but he should. He's pretty clearly a top five or so player in the National League. And so you don't – those guys come to free agency so infrequently. If you're – really, if you're any team with the money, but the Dodgers, perfect example – of course you want to target that guy. And the fact that you'd have overlap for 1 year, you work it out, right? You move a few guys around.
Not a big deal.
That would put, yep. And exactly. And that then in that case, back to the question you asked me before, Seager's probably your long-term shortstop. Lux is your long-term second baseman. You slide Turner to first. Rendon plays third for a while. Eventually,
wow.
as these guys get older, you're right. You move, maybe Rendon becomes a DH. Seager moves to third. They've drafted so well. The Dodgers have drafted so well. They have surplus at multiple spots. They have not, you and I talked about this at the trade deadline. They didn't go out and get a major reliever. And obviously a lot of people argued they should have. And I think there's merit to that, but also they have a lot of pretty good arms internally. They could reach down and call up a Dustin May to help them in the rotation or in the bullpen. They needed a catcher. Well, Will Smith was right there. They needed a second baseman. Oh, hey, Gavin Lux is sitting right there in AAA. They've drafted exceptionally well the last 4 or 5 years, and it gives them all kinds of flexibility.
Yeah, and the fact that, of course, the Will Smith is going to be a cheap player and Gavin Lux is going to be a cheap player.
Yep.
Some of their other guys already in the big leagues haven't gotten expensive yet. That gives you the flexibility to go get a big dog like Anthony Rendon if
yes.
you want to. All right, let's play a game of what should they do next with some teams that are either completely out of it or kind of on the fringes. Let's start with the San Francisco Giants. And here's some parameters for you, okay,
mm-hmm.
in terms of what they have left on their books. Clearly, it's a team in transition. Bruce Bochy, Hall of Fame manager, is leaving after this year. The Giants have 2 more years left of Johnny Cueto for about total of $43 million. Buster Posey, 2 years left, $47 million. Evan Longoria, about $50 million left, 3 years. Brandon Crawford, $30 million left, 2 more years. Brandon Belt, $34 million, 2 more years. Jeff Samardzija, 1 more year, $20 million. So when you look at all of that, I don't see Farhan Zaidi, their head of baseball ops, who, you know, has taken over this year. I think it'll be at least another year before you start to see him really dive in with major acquisitions. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think he should still be in sell mode. Probably should have been in sell mode in July, but they had that short period of success that yeah. made them. I mean, that second wildcard spot, it sort of trick fakes a lot of teams into thinking they're better than they actually are. And I wonder if that was the situation. Did ownership say, well, you can't sell, we're too close? Or maybe the market didn't support it too. But I think if you're in that situation, if you're in Farhan's situation, most of those players you just listed, you should be shopping. And you should be shopping saying, we'll pay most of the salary at this point. We want players in return. We need prospects and we need young major league players, but we actually need more talent coming back as opposed to try to get some salary relief. You can hear Bias Cat really agrees with me on this one.
Yeah. He's a little worked up today.
He really is. I have no idea why. Yeah. Maybe we don't talk enough Giants. Don't you think, other than Posey, and you and I have argued this before, right? Posey's the signature guy. You're not trading him. I would guess ownership is saying you're not trading Buster Posey. Inside knowledge. I'm just assuming he's the one guy you can't deal. Every other one of those players, you either shop now, or maybe in the case of Acueto, you're waiting into next season so teams get to see him pitch and be healthy and hold up. I would imagine that if Johnny Cueto comes back even most of the way, he's pretty valuable next July, and I don't think they're going to be contenders next year. So to me, that's a much better strategy maybe than just saying we're just trying to move the player this offseason. You don't have to because you have 2 years left. Samardzija, on the other hand, you could just put out there and say, look, we'll pay 80% of the salary. Take that, give us one prospect, and we move forward. Try to get any value you can for these players before they reach that nexus where their value essentially drops to zero. Because I think Samardzija at the trade deadline next year, unless he has an amazing season, he probably doesn't have a lot of value left.
No, I totally agree with you. And in some of these deals, maybe you can find some fringy guys who you see value in, a guy like Mikey Strzemski. It's one thing that Farhan's done well this year. And from what I've heard inside that clubhouse, the players really have recognized, you know what, this guy's trying to get better. Like adding a Mikey Strzemski has made them better. You know, there have been a handful of other guys who are not necessarily big names and they're not, you know, huge prospects or anything like that, but they are players who have made them better during the course of the year. The San Diego Padres are closing in on their ninth consecutive losing season. That would match the record set in the first 9 years of the franchise, Keith. And the next 3 years, they have $75 million committed annually to Will Myers, Manny Machado, and Eric Hosmer. And, you know, my one observation about this team, and I can't tell you why this is, but I see this trend happening with the Padres in recent seasons. They have these guys who are touted as they're coming up through the minor leagues, and you're excited about, you know, a guy like a Will Myers when he's a young player. And for whatever reason, they have just disappeared. Like, I'm thinking about Manuel Margot. He hasn't really developed. Hunter Renfro, Franmil Reyes, you know, who was touted when he got to the big leagues. They wound up moving him in a deal this year, and it felt like that they were trying to move him while he still had value. Austin Hedges, you know, a terrific defensive catcher, but he's hitting under 200. And so when we've talked about the Padres in recent seasons, it's, wow, this great farm system with these can't-miss players. A lot of those guys are missing. What do you think?
I feel like there are multiple things going on here. Part of the problem with the Myers and the Hosmer acquisitions, they have targeted a couple of times a type of player who I think is just an exceptionally poor fit for that ballpark. You can't have average, above average power and have that play out in Petco. I mean, it's just that it's suddenly that power is sufficiently sapped. And they always wonder, is that changing hitters' approaches? Because the balls that they hit hard that they thought were going to go out, so they don't go out. And then it can sort of lead into this downward spiral. But even at the start, those guys were not good fits for that particular environment. And they weren't good fits either because they're limited defensively. You know, Myers really never had much of a position. Hosmer's only limited to first base. And those are positions you can otherwise fill, and that the Padres have some prospect depth in the outfield, at least, that could end up at first base. So that's part of the problem. And the other part of the guys you listed, most of the guys you listed, I would make Margot a bit of an exception because he had more defensive value. And I do still hold out some hope. I think there's been slight progress on his front this year. But a lot of those other guys were touted, but not really great prospects. Whereas this next wave, led by Tatis Jr., who has panned out so far in about half a season, Luis Urias, who has not panned out so far, although I still think he's going to hit. And the next wave, that's the wave that is coming up right behind these guys, those guys are better out of the chute. That'll be a better test of their player development processes, particularly at the big leagues, because it seems like they have absolutely had guys develop and progress through the minors. What they have not had yet is enough of those guys get to the majors and break through. And I'm essentially arguing, yeah, but the better prospects are just getting there now. Let's see where they go over the next, say, 18 to 24 months as more of these prospects reach the majors. Tatis Jr. panned out. Paddock panned out. Urias, not yet. I'm certainly not giving up on him. There are more of these guys about to get there. As the Mackenzie Gores and Luis Patinos get to the big leagues, do these guys start to make the impact that we expect them to make? And you know what? If not, if some of these guys aren't panning out, then you can start asking questions. But somebody asked me a very similar question to this on Twitter yesterday. I said it's premature to say that they're having any kind of problem because their absolute best prospects just haven't gotten there yet. They're just getting there now, next year. And that'll be a much sterner test than, you know, talented but flawed prospects like Hunter Renfroe.
And it feels like that the timing in the organization's off. I mentioned all that money, you know, that they spent on Myers, mm-hmm. Machado, and Hosmer. And you and I talked about this at the time on both the Machado and the Hosmer deals, that yep. it didn't feel like that their pitching was close enough. And it still seems like they need another 2 or 3 years for the pitching to yep. step up to the point where you're ready to really contend. But here's the problem. You know, because of those contracts, you need to take advantage of the veterans' value right now. You can't wait 3 years, which is why they're kind of in this weird place where they absolutely need to go out and somehow, you know, get a front of the rotation type guy, whether it's trading prospects for that player or spending money on a free agent. But unless they upgrade that starting pitching, I just can't see them being a serious contender in that division.
Well, this is why I was fine with the Machado deal, because I thought you were buying a little early, but Machado is so young that his peak years will probably still line up with the years where you think that rotation is going to have Gore, Paddock, Patino. You know, maybe there's an outside acquisition somewhere in there, but the core, their top, absolute top tier of pitching prospects is in the major league rotation and contributing at the time that Machado is still in his offensive peak. The problem with the Hosmer deal especially was just so ill-advised, and we both said it at the time.
Yep.
It was because, one, he was just never that good. He was not a good enough player to justify the contract he was being given. That's why there were only two teams after him, and one was the team that already had him and probably valued him differently because he was their own player. But also, you were clearly not going to contend in his peak years. And it made no sense on that basis alone. Even all of the other problems, the blocking Josh Naylor and the overvaluing of Hosmer to begin with, the biggest problem is that by the time you're good pitching, and they have a lot of it coming, got to the majors and was contributing, Hosmer was probably already going to be on the downside of his career, certainly not going to be productive enough to be a first baseman on a playoff caliber club. And I don't know how they get out of this. Like, I feel like Will Myers is essentially unmovable unless you trade him for another yep. terrible contract. I feel the same way about Hosmer. I know there are teams that would love to have Hosmer's character, certainly, but no one's going to take on that contract just to get Hosmer's persona in the clubhouse, again, unless you're just taking on someone else's bad contract. And maybe that's what they have to do. Maybe they find somebody with a terrible pitching contract and say, you know what, we'll just do that, swap it to clear the money, and so that first base is open to give someone like Josh Naylor the full-time job next year.
And you know what? That would all be very expensive. And I wrote at the time mm-hmm. when they signed Machado that, okay, you go down this path, but at some point what that means is ownership's going to have to step up and spend a lot more money than they're comfortable
yes.
spending and making financial decisions that they historically have not made. And in the past, it's always been a crossroad for this organization. I want to ask you about the Angels. Their starting yep. pitching, a 5.33 ERA. Obviously, the tragic death of Tyler Skaggs. And moving forward, it seems pretty clear to me there are not many teams where if I were working in an advisory capacity, I would say, yeah, you need to go spend a lot of money on starting pitching. But I think that's exactly where they stand, especially now that they have the Mike Trout situation settled. And yes, I think it makes sense for them. Go after Garrett Cole. Go after Cole Hamels. Go after, you know, two or three of these guys.
Yep.
Because now's the time with Trout in his prime. What do you think?
I feel like they should be in on every free agent starting pitcher, every good free agent starting pitcher this offseason. And I say that as somebody who, if you look back at stuff I've written about free agents, either in rankings or in valuations of deals, I tend to be pretty down on long-term contracts for starting pitchers because history says that they free agent starting pitchers signed to these long deals. Track record's not very good. Like, I think the historical evidence kind of backs me up on that. if I were in the Angels front office, I'd say, yeah, screw it. Just go. What is Garrett?
Yep.
Garrett Cole wants 7-8 years. Fine. Cole Hamels wants 4 or 5 years, even at his age and with his, you know, with the mileage on his arm. He's still pretty good. Fine. Because you're essentially overpaying. You're giving them the back end of the deal. You're giving them those last 2 years to make sure you get them now. Right, because if you add two really well above average starting pitchers, obviously Garrett Cole is more than that. You add two above average starting pitchers to your rotation. You already have Mike Trout. You have some other good players. Obviously, we sort of like Mike Trout and the Seven Dwarfs. It's not quite like that, but that's sort of how we tend to talk about the Angels, right? But they're still, you know, they're contenders with two. You add two starting pitchers, and hopefully Griffin Canning is back and healthy next year. Joe Adell becomes, makes some kind of impact. Otani is back next year, whatever role they choose to give him next year. There's clearly, they're not that far off, but there's no way for them to get over the hump internally at this point. I think they would absolutely have to go add some pitching from outside.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be their focus for sure. All right, Keith, we've established in this podcast Bias Cat is a big Giants honk. Right?
Apparently so.
I mean,
yes.
It's done. I mean, we have not heard from your cat since we finished talking about the Giants, but in the Giants conversation, very strong opinions. I appreciate it. Good to talk with you.
My pleasure.
Before we hear from Twins manager Rocco Baldelli, hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BUSTER. ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Minnesota Twins have been one of the great stories in baseball this year, and their manager, Rocco Baldelli, is probably the front runner for Manager of the Year in the American League. Well, Chris Singleton of ESPN Radio caught up with him on Wednesday. Give a listen.
All right, Rocco, here we are in the month of September, and your club's 6.5 games out in front of the Cleveland Indians. Managing it all, emotions, looking forward to October a little bit, where you are right now in a series against a good team in the Boston Red Sox, kind of explain what's going on.
Well, you know, we are here in September, and there is a lot going on, but one of the really good things about our group, both staff and players, is that our clubhouse really hasn't changed very much, regardless of what's gone on this year. And our guys have played exceptionally well. As a whole, I think we have to be really happy with the way our guys have performed, but especially happy about the way that we've prepared and kind of focused and locked in each day. And then regardless of what happens in the game, we have a very, you know, consistent atmosphere. And then the next day you show up and it's the same. And if we lose a few games in a row, it's not what we're looking for, but that's fine. We show up the next day and get ready to play. And it's kind of kept us from having too many highs, even with winning some games, and also avoided the lows as well.
It's been less than a year that you were a coach on a staff, and let's walk it back a little bit. Go back to spring training, where everyone's very optimistic about their club. You bringing your team in as far as staff and the roster of players. Where you're at right now compared to the optimism, some of the adversity that you've had to deal with in the season, is it something that you could say that you expected, or is it kind of more like, hey, this is the process that we're just trying to carry out?
Well, I think from early on in the year, it's kind of a new group because we built a new staff in a lot of ways, a new group kind of coming together, and it's a new roster of players as well. There are a lot of talented guys that were here already, and we also brought in a lot of talented guys that were not in this organization. And early on, it was there was a lot of optimism, and we can say that about pretty much any team. You know, in spring training, that's the right time for everyone to be optimistic. But early on, we also felt that we were good and that we could compete. And we started the year off playing pretty well, played some tough teams well early on, and basically proved to ourselves, you know, from the very beginning of the season that we were going to be ready to go every night and play well and compete. And that's all we've asked our guys to do the entire year. We don't ask our guys to do a ton, but we ask our guys to compete and respect everyone and go about their business the right way to continue to grow and learn and things like that. Very simple things, and our guys have taken to it very well.
Your offense leads the league in home runs, home run rate. How do you explain it? We know home runs are up across the board, but night in, night out, you watching this, how do you explain it?
Well, I don't think there's one way to explain it. I think we have a lot of good young players that are kind of growing in their careers. I think they're maturing and turning into the types of players that they're going to be. And we have a few guys that are doing that kind of at the same time. And we also have some veteran guys that have done this for a while that are just good players. And you look up and down the lineup. There were a few guys that have good at bats and, you know, will spray the ball around the park and you know, more of line drive strokes. But we have a lot of guys that if they hit the ball in the barrel, they're plenty strong enough to drive the ball over the fence. And as far as getting specific as to why or how it's happening, I think it's a combination of having an entire lineup each night of good quality hitters that force the opposing pitcher to work. And if one guy doesn't get the job done, the next guy and the next guy all the way through the bottom of the lineup are dangerous, and every single guy could make something happen. And I think that collective feel and kind of environment has led to good things for us.
Lastly, you're from the Rhode Island area, managing back here in Boston as first time as manager. What's this been like?
It's been fun. It's been busy. It's a lot of things. We're only in day two. This is only second day ever. We got a whole one game under my belt in this ballpark, but it was fun. I got a chance to see a lot of people yesterday. A lot of the same media members that I've known since I was in high school that covered high school games, and they're still here and they're still covering these games. So it was really nice. And I'll have a bunch of family and friends here as well. And the environment here is probably just different than most places. It's a different feel. You know, it's for everyone. You know, every opposing manager, staff member, player, everyone comes in and feels a little different here, but it's fun. It's a great place to show up to, and looking forward to tonight.
All right, Rocco, good luck tonight and good luck the rest of the way. We look forward to seeing you in October.
Thank you, Sam.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs is a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. Sarah, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm not on the highway anymore, which is
Thank
a good
God.
Time.
Yeah, that was the scariest interview that I've ever done, where I'm just imagining these cars barreling past you at 80 miles per hour when you're on the side giving us baseball numbers. I felt really bad about that. I don't feel bad about throwing this bleacher tweet at you that we got from Lucas. His question is, with Hyunjin Ryu struggling and Max Scherzer not quite back to form since his return from the injured list, who is leading the Cy Young vote in the National League? And to give more context on that, Ryu has struggled of late. As you know, Sarah, his ERA has dropped down to now 2.45. He's come back to the pack. 3 runs in 4 1/3 innings last night. And there is talk in L.A. that maybe they'll back him off a little bit. Maybe they'll rest him up as we move forward and get him ready for the postseason. And it might be there's going to be more opportunity for other Cy Young Award candidates to move up. Among other guys than Ryu and Scherzer, who do you think might emerge?
You know, I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago when Ryu was on the IL and Scherzer was also hurt at the same time, and I feel like that was already the perfect storm to give Jacob deGrom his shot. And I know he didn't pitch great in that game that ended up even worse for the Mets in other ways, but, I mean, he has the highest WAR of any pitcher according to Fangraphs since June 1st, 4.3 of any pitcher, and it's by far the highest in the National League. The next highest in the National League is Walker Buehler at 3.2. And I think that DeGrom has really distinguished himself. And at a certain point, the fact that Ryu has had injury issues has, you know, may have to have his innings limited in whatever way it may be. And the fact that DeGrom has been there all year is kind of something to his credit as well. And I mean, if you really take out his first, it's about 5 or 6 starts of the season, he's been very close to what he was last year.
I kind of wonder about Jack Flaherty as well. You know, we saw the year that Jake Arrieta won the Cy Young Award in 2015, he basically did it on the strength of having a completely dominant second half. You know, and that's how he wound up winning the voting versus a Zach Greinke, versus a Clayton Kershaw, because he was so good down the stretch. And that's been Jack Flaherty since the All-Star break.
Yeah, no, he's been absolutely outstanding. And if you do, since the All-Star break on the WAR, like I mentioned earlier, he's top in the National League. Verlander is top in baseball, but Jack Flaherty has 2.6 WAR since the All-Star break, which is the best in the National League, and is ahead of DeGrom by 0.1. And he really has been outstanding. I don't know if it's enough of a second half push. I mean, that Arrieta second half push was like, you know, he didn't lose.
Historic.
The team didn't lose. It was so dominating. So it may not be quite enough, but I love the idea of, you know, getting another name in here, right? It's so much fun.
All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three
is 40. So last night, Jorge Soler hit his 40th home run of the season. He'd already captured the franchise record, but no Royals player had ever hit 40 home runs in a season until Jorge Soler did it this season. That means that every single active franchise in the majors now has had a player with a 40 homer season. And it had a 115.7 mile an hour exit velocity, which was the hardest hit home run by any Royals player, tracked by StatCast, which is since 2015. And just to that point, he's been hitting the ball hard all year. I know home runs are up. Obviously, it's harder to evaluate certain guys' seasons, but he already has more barrels, which are batted balls with an ideal combination of exit velocity and launch angle, than any other Royals player has had in a season. And there's never been a Royals player to finish even second in the American League in home runs, and it looks like he's going to do that. So a banner year for him, for sure.
Number two
is 45. So speaking of home runs hit yesterday, Pete Alonso hit his 45th home run yesterday, which gave him sole possession of the major league lead. No rookie has ever led the majors outright in home runs. Only five rookies have even led their league, and two of those tied for the major league lead. But again, none led outright. Aaron Judge led the AL in 2017 with 52 home runs. Mark McGwire led the AL in 1987 and tied for the MLB lead with Andre Dawson. Ralph Kiner led the National League in 1946. And then a couple of very long ago guys, Tim Jordan, led the National League in 1906 and tied for the MLB lead with Harry Davis. And Harry Lumley led the NL in 1904. So those are your only rookies to even lead their league in home runs. And Alonso was leading the majors.
Number one
is five. That's how many home runs Jock Peterson hit in a six at-bat span that culminated last night. He's the first player with five homers in a six at-bat span since Josh Hamilton in 2012, according to Elias, and obviously that included a four-homer game. The last Dodger to do it was Sean Green in 2002 in a span that also included a four-homer game. And I really like this one from Stats. He had five home runs in a six at-bat span, Peterson, and the other at-bat, that other one, was a double. So he had six consecutive at-bats with an extra base hit, which tied the NL record, which was set by Larry Walker in May of 1996.
Yeah, it does feel like Jock Peterson has matured as a hitter. We saw at the Home Run Derby, he had all these younger guys just trying to kill the ball. And Jock Peterson, you see in his face, he had like a particular strategy that he was following. And that's the way, what you see in him when he's taking his plate appearances, for sure, for the Dodgers this year. Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
Okay, Buster, here's the first one this morning. Comes from Peter R. at AstroPCR13. When he inevitably goes in the Hall of Fame, which hat will Justin Verlander wear? Not going to lie, I still think of him overall as a Tiger, but maybe a few more excellent seasons with the Astros will change that.
Yeah, Peter, I think you have a right read on it. I think he's got to reach a lot more milestones, have a lot of more big moments for the Astros before they come into play in that conversation. But you know what? If he winds up winning 300 games in his career and number 300 is with the Astros and they win another World Series, then, yeah, I guess it's a possibility.
Next one, CrossFit School of Sweat at School of Sweat. We always hear how starting pitchers can't get through a lineup a third time. How many times will the bullpens have to fail to get through it once before the mindset changes back to letting pitchers go deeper when they're pitching well?
Yeah, CrossFit, I think it's starting to turn. I just get that sense in talking with executives around baseball because they've just seen all these relievers having issues now, breaking down as well.
Another one from Sportsfan AK at Sportsfan AK1. Do you think we could ever see the MLB's version of Hard Knocks? Would there be enough interesting material? What would be a good team to follow?
I do think there would be enough interesting material. I don't think teams would go along with it because, Troy, you know the baseball mindset. It's like, don't change anything. Don't call attention to yourself. It's the same reason, for the same reason that a lot of players don't like the bat flips and that sort of thing. They would not like to have it be followed around by a bunch of cameras.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'd like to see the Baltimore Orioles, though, with all the dugout flare-ups they've had this season. Got to keep them interesting somehow.
Well, there you go. Except I think for a lot of fans, they wouldn't know the names of three quarters of the people, right? So I don't think that would be as much in play. Let's say, you know, the usual suspects, right? The Yankees, the Red Sox, the Cubs, because I think, you know, Anthony Rizzo's an entertaining guy. His byplay with Chris Bryant, Joe Maddon, although he's probably not going to be manager of the Cubs next year. Yeah, that would be an interesting candidate.
I don't know. There's a lot of there's so many dynamic personalities. I think there would definitely be enough interesting material. I mean, these are professional athletes. They make a bunch of money. I think there's definitely reason to be interested. Last one comes from Don Irvine at Don Irvine. Why doesn't the MLB change the definition of a quality start to 7 innings pitched with 3 or fewer runs allowed? It seems that the current standard of 6 innings pitched has been a driver of the explosion of relievers used in recent years.
Yeah, I don't think the stat is driving that. I just think it's the metrics, you know, in relation to what pitchers do facing a lineup third time through. I actually agree with you, Don, but I would go different in a different direction than you. Rather than 3 runs and 7 innings, I'd give a quality start based on how starting pitchers are used in this era to 2 runs and 5 innings. Let's face it, because there are not very many starting pitchers who are seeing the 7th inning these days.
Thank you for the tweets this morning. Rena Bonino will be back with us tomorrow for the Bleacher Tweets. Just keep them coming. Use the hashtag Bleacher Tweets.
That's it for today. My thanks to Rocco Baldelli, to Chris Singleton, to Sarah Langs, to Keith Law, and to Troy Farkas, who was wrong again. I can't believe you didn't think that was a great catch.
I stand by it.
That was an unbelievable catch. That's crazy. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.